like a bunch of owls in here.
Go ahead.
All right. Man, I want to thank y'all for coming, kind of a captive audience, some of y'all. But this is an experience if you come into it ready to learn, willing to learn, willing to pay attention, man. This will propel your ability and your effectiveness as a sponsor, and this will help you understand and grasp what we're trying to accomplish in the step process. But it's going to be dependent upon you to dig in and to receive what's being given. So, you know, if you ain't got a pen, let me know. I got some extra. All right. The church here, we got cigarette butt buckets out there. This is the church that I attend regularly. And so I ask that y'all please give the respect that you would anywhere else, but definitely pay attention, be conscious of what you're doing, throw your cigarette butts away, do all that. I do want to thank Miss Julie and our preacher, Pastor Steve, for having us, giving us a space to do that. Want to thank Tarek and Brandon also. It's awesome to get to co-sponsor an event with y'all. The work that y'all do in the Atlanta recovery community is, I mean, it's unbelievable the effect and the ripple that happens as a result of the effort that y'all do outside of your program and inside of the launching pad. So thank y'all. Yeah, man, y'all, you know, get out of it what you can. I'm going to pray. They may pray, they might. I'm going to pray for us real quick and pray for this experience, and then I'll turn it over to them. So, God, I want to thank you for this opportunity to be in here, to experience you, for the men that are in this room, the women that are in this room, the gift of sobriety that so many of us have gained by a process of working the steps. This deal has changed my life, Lord, and I thank you so much for it. I thank you for the church that I've become a part of to allow for this event to take place. Thank you for Tarek and Brandon. Ask that you come into our room. Let us feel your presence. Speak to each and every one of us. Help us understand and comprehend and gain what you would have us gain from this, from the next 3 days, that we can internalize it, receive it, and then carry it on to the next guy that still suffers. Lord, thank you so much for this opportunity. In your name we pray, amen.
Amen. Amen.
Y'all give a hand to these two gentlemen. Thank you.
You want to go first?
Just set the table first.
My name's Eric. I'm an addict and alcoholic.
Yes, sir.
I will explain to you, like, I introduced myself as an addict and alcoholic because I am both. But we're going to dig really deep this weekend. I don't think if you're one, you're automatically the other. But your experience is going to tell you what you are. So we call this the wall. It's the what any length looks like big book experience. I have an intent for the weekend. My intent is when you leave out of here on Sunday, you will never not know the answer to how it works. You will know exactly how it works. Whether or not you're able to make a decision and make a commitment to live this way of life, that's going to be your experience. Our objective this weekend is to share with you our experience with the mechanics of working the steps out of the big book, and you'll know exactly what any length looks like. But then it's a decision that you have to make, whether or not you're willing to submit to truly a way of life other than what you want to do. Okay? To achieve long-term and permanent recovery, not one day at a time. We'll talk about that. We're talking about permanent recovery if a specific set of instructions are followed. What we're going to do in this first session is we want to tell you a little bit about ourselves. And in order to do that, we're going to share our experience with alcoholism and addiction and our experience with the recovery process. And Brandon's going to go first, and then I'll close it out for this first session. We're going to try 50-minute sessions throughout the course of the weekend with 10 to 15-minute breaks. And we're going to start each session with a 2-minute meditation, and we're going to do the set-aside prayer, which we're going to have up on the projector. we've all need to get centered. Our minds are traveling the universe while our bodies are sitting in these chairs sometimes, and we need a way to be here. Be here and be present. So with that, I turn it over to Brandon.
Hello, everyone. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a member of Cocaine Anonymous. My name is Brandon. We will try to entertain you and give you lots of information, but really whatever information we give you, it's up to you to digest it and absorb it. Usually when we do one of these weekends, we I'll speak on Friday night and Tarek will speak on Saturday night, and we'll tell, you know, I can't really say that, you know, in the rooms we talk about tell my story. It's not really my story. It's this experience that I'm a part of, because I don't get to claim the entirety of it. It's something that I'm engaged in. It's a process that I go through. So we're going to tell you a little bit about how we came to experience this power that I'll call God, I'll call the universe, I'll call whatever it is, and the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that got me there. I'm sitting here in preparation for this. This came to mind. We'll cover these pages again, but so what about the real alcoholic? So some may start off as a moderate drinker. They may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts. Out of the gate, guys, I was a hard drinker. I was never one of those moderates. I drank for one reason alone, as I was going to get messed up. That's it. I didn't drink in high school. I didn't start until I was a freshman in college. And really, I made up for lost time in a hurry. I started drinking Golden Grain and Kiss Fruit Punch because it killed the taste. I didn't like the taste of beer. But in the end, that's all I was drinking was beer, because I felt like I had this control over beer because I could track how many I've actually had. I don't know the point where I began to lose control over the amount I took in, because, like I said, my intent when I started drinking was always just to get messed up. So there was never this desire to moderate. There was never this desire to have just a few. I did absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking that I could sit up here and tell you about. I could tell you how I was a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, how my personality when drinking did not resemble my normal one at all. But even when I wasn't drinking, there was still that internal flaw, that internal malady within me that demanded that I seek relief. There was a sense of not fitting in that I always sought relief from that experience, or numbing of the experience, the outward experience, and I got that through alcohol. I was not a guy that progressed into other things, because alcohol for me worked. It did everything I needed it to do, and then some. I had a promising career ahead of me early on in my work career. I had potential from the time I was a kid, potential all the way through my adult life. Everybody always said, oh, you got a lot going for you, but I never seemed to have that ability to live up to whatever that was. Went through 7 jobs in 6 years. That typically doesn't happen for non-alcoholics or addicts. Some of those I left by choice, some of those I was forced out. A couple of those lasted a couple weeks. Anybody have experience with that? My bosses were just completely unreasonable, right? It was always somebody else's fault. It was always the economy, the circumstances. It was always they didn't understand me. They didn't see my potential. This self-sabotage, this desire to never really work as hard as I could work, because if I never really worked as hard as I could work, I could always say that I never really tried. And so that was my experience. That was my life. That's how I went through my existence. I had this wonderful evening in late May of 2011 where I had no desire to continue in this existence. Up to that point, there was always the kids, the wife, the family, what would you guys say about me, was the reason that I didn't go and off myself. But this particular night, none of that mattered. I was tired. I was sick of living. And I had an evening where I sat outside the room where I kept my pistol, and for something like 2-3 hours, I struggled with going into the room as if it had a force field on it, because the intent was to go in that room and shoot myself in the face, but for some reason I couldn't get in there. So instead I continued to go back to the beer fridge and grab a new one and grab a new one and grab a new one. And at some point, I guess I gave up like I usually did in most experiences, and decided that I was done with that, and then I'd regroup and try it again tomorrow. So my wife was out with some friends. The kids were in the house. I took the kids over to a friend's house, asked if they could spend the night, and then proceeded to drive an hour, hour and a half to my parents to make sure I was not home when my wife got home. I got to their house, couldn't get inside, and ended up passing out on the back patio with patio cushions and towels. I took my dog with me so that I didn't pull off the side of the road and hit a bridge or something like that, because I wouldn't hurt my dog. And so woke up the next morning with my dad bumping me with his foot, wondering why I was asleep on his back patio. And realizing in that moment that I had committed the fatal flaw, is that I hadn't come up with a story. It was like the first time ever. Like I always had it all planned out. When you caught me, I knew what I was going to say, and if you said this, I was going to say this, and this was going to happen, and that was going to happen. But like all of the lies that I had always told, like I hadn't come up with one this morning. And so because I wanted to regroup, I asked my dad to go inside, really so I could come up with a good lie to explain to him why I was sleeping on his back patio. And this is the way I describe it, this is the way I always describe it, and the way I'm describing it does it no justice. In those moments when he went back inside, the sun was brighter, the air was crisper, and the birds were louder, and something had shifted inside of me. I had woken up to the existence that I was living in, and I had woken up to the possibility that maybe this was worth continuing on forward with. Okay, so then I had to go in and tell my parents. You know, well, Sarah and I we got in a fight, and I just decided to come out here. That seemed plausible at the time, because she had been threatening to leave me for a number of years, and so. It was always just that she was completely unreasonable on ag. I mean, it had nothing to do with me or my drinking or anything else. I mean, usually wives enjoy when their husband goes through 7 jobs in 6 years. Go figure, right? But so that experience, I knew it had something to do with drinking, and it scared me. It scared me sober for 4 days. Wanting to shoot myself in the face, knowing it had something to do with alcohol, sobered me up for 4 days. 4 days later, I was back at it. About 2 weeks later, I'm on an island with no bridge off the coast of South Carolina in the middle of the week. We were there from Sunday to Sunday. My wife announces to me and to her family all at the same time that she no longer wants to be married to me. This was a shock to me. Didn't see it coming. In that moment, everything that I thought was important in life was ripped from me. Wife was gone. Kids were gone. House was gone. Car was in her name, so that was gone. So I'd resolved myself to the fact that I was just going to return home after the vacation, and I was going to bury myself in work. I was going to make so much money that she was going to regret the day that she ever left me. Returned to work on Monday, and they fired me. And in that period of time, where I was stuck on the island with this family that was telling me all the things that were wrong with me, it was suggested that perhaps I had a drinking problem. News to me. But I had entered into that strange little place of grace, that strange little place where I was willing to look at life from a different perspective. I'd failed at trying to die, and I had made a complete failure of everything that I thought was important in my life. And I was left with nothing but myself in that moment. Now, for those of you who have had the experience of losing everything, being homeless, wife leaving you, welcome. There's a pretty good chance you're on your way to a meaningful life. If you still have that person in your life that always bails you out, that never leaves you, that always sticks around, you might not be done. Because I can tell you with almost 100% certainty that if she had taken me back after that experience, that the heat would have been off and I could have just reverted back to where I was. But see, I have this very, I think that whatever your higher power is, whatever your God is, whatever you pray to, takes on your personality. And I tend to be a little bit of a smartass, so my God tends to be a little bit of a smartass. And so what I think happened, looking back, one of the guys that I really like the words that he uses that's in this program, he says, life is lived forward and understood in reverse. Looking back at my life, I have the ability to see that this was absolutely necessary. This complete failure of my existence was necessary for me to change, for me to go forward. And so for those of you who are at that place where there appears to be no hope, there's probably hope for you. If in your head you still have a plan, if you know that if this changes and I do this, I just get the right sponsor, I just learn how to look at these words in this book the right way, if I just get a new job, if I just get a new relationship, if I just get these people off my back, you're probably not done. I could not be done a moment before I was done. 24 hours before that terrible moment where everything was ripped from me, I still had a plan. And it wasn't until I got to that place of complete defeat, that complete surrender, that I was actually willing to do something different. And so my God, I think what happened is that I lived through that experience of not dying. And I think what happened was when I started drinking 4 days later, the big man just said, you're just not going to get it, are you? So here's what we're going to do. We're going to take everything else away from you. And in that moment, that grace opened up. Now, a bunch of magical things happened to where I ran into a buddy that had magically quit drinking about 8 months prior. I didn't know how he did that, so I wanted to inquire. If he was going to meetings, he took me to my first meeting. I met with he and his sponsor before the first meeting I went to, and his sponsor passed across a third edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, what's this? He's like, it's a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, you guys got a book? He's like, yeah, actually the book came first. And so in that first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, what happened to me is I was exposed to the fact that they've got this manual that tells you how to do this stuff. And then I ended up auditing the course for a while, hanging around in meetings, listening to what people said, hearing all sorts of jingles that really didn't make any sense to me. All these slogans and stuff. And it's like, well, how does that really work, though? Don't drink no matter what. You see, I drank no matter what. So how does don't drink no matter what work? But I would realize in those moments that there were certain, that when I would go to those meetings from time to time, there was these handful of people that there was something different going on in their existence than the rest of the people. There were three and four people in a room that seemed to kind of, you can see it in their eyes. There's a different glow, there's a different light. Now, understanding what I understand about the spiritual world now, there's a reason for that. There's a reason why people that are spiritually hooked up look different in their eyes. You can see the power of God working in their eyes. If you can't see it, it's probably not there. They're probably completely still in control, or thinking they are. They're asleep, dreaming that they're awake. But so I would see these people in these meetings that seem to have this different level of existence than the people, the rest of them. There were the other people that just kind of hung out in the meetings, that look like about half this room does right now, that's just kind of looking down or looking away or it, having their own experience trying to wonder, well, what are we going to eat for dinner, or what are we going to do tomorrow, or do I really have to listen to these guys for all weekend long? Hey, cool, whatever. It's your experience. Do whatever you want with it. It doesn't offend us a bit. But so I wanted to know what was going on with those people, because I'm a pretty judgmental person. I was trying to figure out, what is it about these people that there was something else going on with them? And so, like I said, started watching them, judging them, trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with them. Okay, they made a mistake. They're full of shit, right? Judging them for the most minuscule action that they took instead of looking at their body of work, right? And then the guy that was attempting to take me through the steps suggested that I go to this retreat out in Conyers at the Monastery of the Holy Spirit. And there was this guy from Texas coming, and he and his brother were gonna have this take these people through the book over the course of a weekend. And when I walked into this room where there were probably somewhere between 30 and 60 people, everybody that was in that room had that thing in their eye. They seemed to be hooked up at a different level. And it was very confusing to me, because I had only seen three or four of them from time to time in meetings. And so, as I did, as I started observing them, and the thing that I came to the conclusion of is that these people had all worked the steps. And the majority of them had worked the steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then this guy from Texas gets up and he starts talking, and he starts talking about this book. And what he's talking about, guys, is not what I was hearing in meetings. What he was talking about, like, made sense. You know, like, there's, when somebody speaks a spiritual truth to you and you're willing to listen to it, you hear it. And when you hear it, it's not like a, yeah, it's like a, it hits you and you wake up and you're like, that's truth. Absolutely, I know that that's true. And this guy was speaking truth from in front of the room, and it occurred to me in that moment, holy cow, I don't have to go on. It was about 90 days dry at that time. Hadn't worked a step one. No, I didn't want to die because I had been through that experience, but life didn't seem to be changing. Everything just kind of seemed to be stagnant. All the struggles with the relationships that I was having, all the emotions that I was dealing with, they were still there. And so, as a result of that retreat, I got a new sponsor and changed the course of my existence. And from that day to this day, it has been a steady incline towards where I am today. You're going to hear a lot of things from us up here that we're going to talk about it from a spiritual realm, from a realm that sounds like it's not possible. Take note, log it, explore it later, because what you have in front of you is not people that just came into Alcoholics Anonymous or Cocaine Anonymous and showed up this way. What you see in front of you is two people that believe that the spiritual path is continuous and demands constant growth. And so a year from now, if you see the same person sitting in front of you, I would be very disappointed in myself. Because it is never my desire to be the same. It is my desire to progress constantly and change. It is my desire to look at life from a different way. I pretty much all I listen to or read anymore are spiritual books. And there's some concepts that I was listening to in my 48-hour road trip that I was just on that I hadn't even finished playing with, guys. You might hear about some of them, but it's like, that's what my life is today. And what we're going to talk about this weekend is the mechanics of how to go through that process, and we're going to shed some light on some stuff that maybe you've never even considered. And we're not the end-all be-all on these books. We're not complete gurus on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous, but what we're here to do is share our experience, that maybe it'll get you a little bit excited about going and exploring your experience. Maybe some of our stories will be funny. Maybe they'll be sad. Maybe we'll challenge you. Maybe we'll piss you off. If we do, good. Take note. Come and ask us about the things that we piss you off about. Because what that is that's your thinking mind in retreat. That's your thinking mind trying to process what we just said and arguing and saying that can't be possible. Good. If I show up in column one of your inventories, on some level I've done my job. Most of the sponsees that I sponsor today, I end up in their inventory, and they always feel really bad about like reading it to me. And I remember the first one that I read to Tarek, where I had a resentment against him. He laughed, and I couldn't believe that he laughed at these terrible things I was saying about him in this inventory. I know now that the reason why he laughed is because it had nothing to do with him. And he knew that. It was just my perspective of looking at it. So if we challenge you to the point where you're disturbed, come ask questions. Please ask questions. Because, like I said, I was homeless, jobless, womanless, in every... 37 years old, I returned to living with my parents. Not my plan. So hopefully you guys don't have to wait that long. Hopefully something we say will challenge you enough that you'll want to go and change the course of your existence. So, Tarek.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you, Brandon.
I can listen to Brandon all weekend. I think I felt like I wanted to go sit out in the audience for the rest of the weekend. Brandon and I are fully aware. Can you guys hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Brandon and I are fully aware we're not here to talk to all of you guys. Our hopes is at some point in the weekend, our spirit is going to touch the spirit of a few of you. Maybe more. We would love to touch everybody, but the reality is we've done enough of these, and we do things like this to know that's just not what's going to happen. A lot of you guys are sitting in your chairs, but I guarantee you, your mind is not here. You're not present. You got a million things you're thinking about. That's how I existed before the 12 steps. I was stuck in this rut of going to sober living and treatment centers and doing that whole circuit, thinking somehow a solution was in the treatment center or the sober living, when it's not. They're all just fingers, hopefully, fingers on a hand to point you to God. And when I say the word God, I don't get a label. I don't get some mental construct. The word life is synonymous with the word God in my experience. It's unfolding. It's very freeing that way. I'm able to investigate many different traditions because the underlying spiritual truths are absolute through all of them. That's what I've discovered, and it makes the spiritual path of recovery using the 12 steps exciting. Because there's a sentence that I value more than anything in our big book: be quick to see where religious people are right, make use of what they offer. And that's the exciting part about this stuff. So our goal this weekend is just to excite some of you. That's it. Get you excited about it. My sobriety date, my rebirth date's November 5th, 2007. I was separated from crack cocaine and whiskey on that date. I did a lot of heroin, smoked a lot of meth, did a lot of Oxycontin. But the big book has this wonderful little catchphrase that you hear in the rooms all the time. It says, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and only one substance made me pitiful and demoralized me, and it was crack cocaine. So crack cocaine was my master. Simple. It's easy for me to see. Complete control. I could not control once I started, and I couldn't stay away from the first blast, no matter how great the necessity or the wish to do so. And I had some of that with whiskey, but I just, you know, whenever I ended up in a sober living or a treatment center, you asked me why I was there. The word alcohol never even came out of my mouth. Cocaine came out of my mouth. I'm here because I have a problem with crack cocaine. And it was almost as if I lived this existence between 2003 and 2007, where on the days that I did wake up, because there are a lot of days where I didn't sleep, when I did wake up, it was like I bowed to this throne and this altar with a big fucking 50,000 crack rock, you know, Tyrone Bingham's crack rock. And I turned my life and my will over to this crack rock, and I said, "Oh, King Crack, what are we doing today?" All right, that's what I did. I've got the trauma, right? I'm a big proponent in therapy. I've been in therapy over half of the 10 years I've been clean and sober. I was molested by a family member between age 5 and 7. I experienced a severe case of abandonment between that same time period. And, you know, I had a father that physically, emotionally, verbally abused me, and that was alcoholic. My uncle died of alcoholism. My father, although his death certificate says liver cancer, he died because of alcoholism. And I have an aunt who also probably died from alcoholism. So I caught the genetic bullet. My alcoholism evolved into addiction because I did a lot of drugs, and I had the same loss of control around that. And then it progressed until I met my master, crack cocaine. Now, I was a star athlete in high school, so drugs were not a big deal to me because my entire identity was based on my athleticism, and nothing was going to come between me and sports. Although when I reflect back on my experience with alcohol, I was a guy that bowed to the porcelain god a lot of the weekends where I drank. And if I reflect back, a lot of people I hung out with did not bow to the porcelain god every single time they drank. Does that mean if you bow to the porcelain god, that makes you alcoholic? No. It's intent. When I started drinking on Friday night, hanging out with everybody, my intent was not to bow to the porcelain god. So loss of intent is where you find your physical aspect of your alcoholism. I couldn't control the amount I drank most of the time. I didn't have a mental obsession for alcohol in high school. I had the physical feature for alcoholism in high school, and I smoked some pot. And I graduated from high school, and I discovered the Grateful Dead and Widespread Panic. And my entire life changed at that point. I got to college, and I immediately became a weekend warrior. We would leave school on Thursday. It didn't matter where Panic was playing. If it was within like a 10 or 12-hour drive, we were going. And I would go Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Sometimes I'd make it back from Monday classes. Sometimes I wouldn't. And psychedelics started, you know, huffing nitrous oxides, you know, eating Valium and Klonopin and smoking pop. I hadn't done any cocaine yet, no heroin yet, no meth yet. And then 1999, my buddy, we were at this bar, and we closed the bar down. I'll never forget it. We got back to his place about 4 in the morning, and he pulled out a big bag of cocaine, and I ripped my first gagger. It was a big half-gram line. And I knew I had arrived. When Bill Wilson says he had arrived, I had something discovered me on that night. And immediately my life, you know, the big book says spiritual experiences come in the form of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, attitudes, and emotions, which had been guiding my life up to that point, were completely cast aside, and a new set of motives and conceptions began to dominate me in that moment. Immediately, I began selling cocaine. Immediately, cocaine became the centerpiece of so many of my activities. And I was still drinking, but the drinking didn't faze me because of the cocaine that was there. I could drink a lot more on the cocaine. And that was 1999. I was still doing other drugs. The deal was, you know, when I would go on my runs with Oxycontin and heroin and meth, and I always only got them because somebody came through and had access to them, and I would buy as much as I could. And when they were gone, I mean, I got dope sick a handful of times. You give me enough cocaine, whiskey, and Valium, I'm going to make it through being dope sick. So I don't completely identify with the heroin addict. I just don't, because all I cared about was cocaine. The only substance that I turned into seek and destroy mode for was cocaine. Nothing else. you have your own substance that does that to you. I'm a guy that wants to dissect your first step so you really understand what your truth is. Because here's the deal. When I sit down to win the entire confidence of a crackhead, I can do it in 10 minutes. I speak crackhead language. When I'm working with a heroin addict, I don't win their confidence. It takes me a few times of meeting with them before I win their confidence. And I got to dig much deeper into my experience to pull out some stories to get them to sort of say, this guy understands where I'm coming from. Alcoholics, the same thing. It takes me a little bit longer to win their confidence. But you sit me down with a meth addict and a cocaine addict, I win your confidence pretty damn quick. And you're more likely to follow my directions when I win your confidence. Okay? So if you're being sponsored by someone right now and you're just like, man, this guy has not been where I've been, you need to fucking get a new sponsor. I'm going to tell you that right now. Why? Because I'm not saying it. The situation cannot work. What I am saying is, when you become when you're no longer spiritually fit, and the voice of the liar comes back in your mind, the voice of the liar is going to use anything to separate you. And one of the things it's going to unconsciously do to you, it's going to start to tell you the guy that's trying to help you is not like you, and you're not going to call him as often. Maybe you don't follow all of his instructions. And then your mind says, you know what, I'm going to get a new sponsor. And then instead of getting a new sponsor, you keep putting it off a few days. And before you know it, you're not going to meetings, you're not accountable to anyone, you're not working any steps, and then life throws the curveball, and you got to have an anesthetic to deal with it. That's how it plays out. So I entered the dark ages of my life in 2003 when my buddy and his girlfriend showed up at my house. And they learned how to cook cocaine, and I sold a lot of cocaine. And so then it became sitting in my house smoking ounces and ounces of cocaine and not paying the people that had given me those ounces and ounces of cocaine. It got to the point where my own brother, who I worked with, was threatening to kill me because I wasn't paying my brother for what he was giving me. And once the crack cocaine entered the picture, I say I was a daily crack smoker, but that'd be an exaggeration. I'd smoke crack for like 5 or 7 days straight and then pass out for 2 days and then get up and do it again. So there were 2 days there where I wasn't smoking crack. But this was my life. I got fired from an amazing job. I had a corner office. I was an analyst. I had a putting green in my office. And I had this uncanny ability to stay up all night smoking crack. And then around 5, 6 in the morning, I eat a bar, eat a Klonopin. I pace around the house. I get into the shower. I take a shower. I put all my work clothes on. I get to the office. I try to sneak back past the receptionist without making eye contact with her. I get down to my corner office. I close the door. I put Do Not Disturb on the phone until about 10 o'clock when I quit tweaking out. I open the door to the office. I take Do Not Disturb off the phone, and then I fall asleep at my desk. And then I start getting written up. And then HR calls me in the office and says, look, we really like you, but you fall asleep at your desk, you don't show up for work, you do no call, no shows. We need you to show up to work or we're going to have to terminate you if you get written up again. And 2 weeks later, I got fired. And granted, through all this time, I'm on the road, off the road. I tried to go to grad school, got kicked out of grad school. I'd disappear and get on the road with panic. I'd come back after a tour, try to get a real job, lose that job. Get a job parking cars and then lose that job sometimes. Go to another valet company. This was my MO for years. And after getting fired from that job, I landed in treatment the first time. And I fell victim to what most of us fall victim to. I show up at the treatment center on day one, and you ask me, what are you willing to do to recover? I'm willing to do anything to recover. But that's a lie, right? You know, some of the people sitting in this room found out they had to attend this event this weekend, right? And immediately started bitching and moaning about it, right? So you're not willing to do whatever you have to recover, clearly, right? You've got terms and conditions on your recovery. So I don't know if you guys are going to identify with this, but you show up at the treatment center, you're completely willing, that you attend all these groups, you go to IOP, and you get to learn all these, you know, things. And then you start working out, so you start to physically get a little bit better. You start eating, because you probably haven't been eating very well, at least I didn't, so I started to put some weight back on. And then I start going to meetings, I'm trying to act serene, and I'm trying to practice those one-word principles behind every step, which are bullshit, because I'm going to tell you those, the 12 steps are the principles. Because what happens when we use those one word principles behind the steps, we don't work the step, we try to work the principle behind the step, right? I need to be honest, and I need to have perseverance, and I need to be forgiving, and all that stuff. The 12 steps are the principles. Byproduct of working the steps into your life is you will live those other principles out. But the steps must be worked. And so I start going to the gym. I start working out. I'm going to meetings. I'm a meeting-making fool. I'll tell you that right now. I probably did 180 meetings in those 90 days. And I got a job. I got a little bit of money in my pocket. And then a girl started talking to me, and I had arrived. I was in recovery now, right? I was in recovery. And then life throws a curveball, and I need an anesthetic to cope with the curveball. So what do? I'm going to pop a couple Valium. I'm going to smoke a bowl. I'm going to drink a Budweiser because crack cocaine was my problem. And then I set the terrible cycle off again. And so this was my MO for that period of 3 years. In and out of sober living, halfway house, treatment, counseling, therapy, all of it. No one ever once told me, hey, buddy, if you fit the description of the alcoholic or the addict that's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and you've completely lost control and the power of choice, that you're going to have to work these 12 steps and take the darkest part of your life, your biggest liability, convert it into an asset so you can show other people how to work the 12 steps, and in turn, you're going to save your life and their life. Not one damn person at any of those programs ever told me that. They just took my fucking money. And it sounds like I'm a little bit aggro with it, because I am. It's like a hidden secret. That's why we're here. That is the whole purpose. If you fit the description of the alcoholic or the addict that's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to have to show people how to work the 12 steps if you want to die clean and sober. All right? That's another thing. Now you've heard the truth, so you can't run out of here and say you don't know the truth. All right? There are other people that are going to give you different versions of it. It may have worked for them. You know what you need to find out if they got what you got. Because I know what I have. Now I was stripped of power, choice, and control. I never get it back. And so in 2007, I lost another job. And then I began selling drugs again like I'd always done. And I got arrested with two Schedule I drug trafficking charges down in the state of Florida on my way into a panic show. And this is a cliche, but I'm going to use it anyway. God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. It was one of the greatest blessings in my life, because I'd been up for 5 days smoking crack. I was doing 160 milligrams of OxyContin a day and smoking a lot of DMT. And I was losing my mind. I had no business being on the road. And I get arrested. I stay up all night in jail. I'm in Duval County, which is the equivalent of Rice Street down in Jacksonville. It was a nasty, nasty place. They found a guy dead in his cell while I was there. I was in a pod with 72 guys. And in this pod I was in, there was this grand staircase. It's not really a grand staircase, just a staircase that comes down on each side with a phone to use at the bottom of the stairs. And I remember my parents wouldn't talk to me. My best friend wouldn't talk to me. My brother wouldn't talk to me. I remember hanging up the phone. And for the first time in my life, I completely felt alone. Like the gates of hell were closing in on me, and I stood at the gate of insanity and death. I couldn't see my life without cocaine and whiskey, and I couldn't see my life with cocaine and whiskey. I'd literally reached that jumping off place. I didn't know what to do. I had no plans and designs about how to get myself out of this one. And it was a beautiful place once I reflect back on it. Because if you have plans and designs, you're probably not done. And I had no plans and designs. I was surrendered before I ever worked a step. The mental obsession for me was removed before I ever worked a step. The big book says God either has removed your obsession or he hasn't. And so nobody would talk to me. A buddy of mine got me a lawyer eventually, and I went to an arraignment that I had. And now, I hadn't seen my mom in quite some time. They trucked us into the courthouse. I was shackled at my knees, shackled at my ankles, my ankles and my wrists. And I remember walking in, and my attorney walked up to me, and I said, "Have you seen my mom?" And she says, yeah, she's right over here behind you. And I turned and looked, and I saw this woman that was frail. She was ghost white, looked like she hadn't eaten in a long time, and she almost collapsed right there in the courtroom. And it was as if everything went dark, and there was this light, this tunnel of light between my mother and I. And in that moment, I was split wide open. In that moment, I became willing to do whatever I had to do to never have the capability of doing that to someone that I care about. I was crushed by a self-imposed crisis that I could not postpone or evade. That's my description of surrender. And that is the part of the first step that you cannot work. And I'm going to get into that later. But surrender is not something that can be worked. It's something that happens through us. It's like Brandon said, you know, it's an experience that's lived through us. And I had a few other spiritual experiences. You're going to hear me talk about this concept all weekend long. It's called the voice of the liar. When I was surrendered, the voice inside my head that would always try to talk me out of those things that were in my best interest, it was put into remission. It's like character defects. They never really get removed. They go into remission, then they come out of remission. They go back into remission, then they come out. I mean, think about it. Addiction is our greatest character defect. Alcoholism. What happens if you don't continue to seek treatment for it through the 12 steps? It comes out of remission. Same thing's true with all our defects of character. And in that moment, the voice of the liar was completely snuffed out for me. And I'm sitting there, and I'm scared to go from my cell to get my tray, because every time I go from cell to tray, I got to deal with a lot of crap between the cell and the tray. And so to get out of my cell, I started going to Bible study. And in Bible study, I kept hearing things that reminded me of the 12 steps. And so it was as if the universe, God, higher power, creative intelligence, whatever you want to call it, was living through me, providing me with direction. Direction was like, hey, you keep seeing and hearing things about the 12 steps, go back to the 12 steps. And then I started reading these spiritual books that were being passed around the pod. And I kept on seeing things I'd heard in 12-step meetings. I'd gone to big book studies. I'd gone to some really good 12-step meetings in the 3 years I've been in and out. And so I knew, like the voice said to me, go back to the Sandy Springs CA meeting. Go back and find Randy. Go back and find Dante. Like this total plan came into view. And I didn't question any of it. Another description of surrender. You receive this information. You know it is truth. And you do not question it. And I didn't question it. So 5 weeks after being in there, they released me, and I had to do 90 days inpatient. And so I get up. I went to a treatment center up in Cumming, Georgia. I got there early in the week on a Tuesday, and I was in a house with 17 guys, and not a one of them cared about really recovering. They wanted to get off the paper, and they had some consequences, and they wanted to get their family back. And so for me, convincing the overnight staff to get us to a meeting that was 40 minutes away was brutal. But, you know, the big book says we're self-forerun riot and we live by self-propulsion, and it came in really handy with me for the next 3 days. And so I persisted until I convinced them to take us to this meeting on Friday night. And so we get to, you know, I'm trying to get in touch with these two guys that were given to me as guides for this process I needed to get involved in. And so the main guy I was trying to call, his phone wasn't working. And so we get to this church on a Friday night in Sandy Springs. It's a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And we're late getting to the meeting. It's raining. There's an awning in front of the church. It's like something out of a movie. We park the van. I'm beelining it to the church. But there's one guy on his cell phone outside of the church. He hasn't gone into the meeting yet. And it's the guy I'm looking for. I walk up to Randy and I said, hey, man, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. I don't want to die living this way. Just tell me what to do. And I started meeting with this guy once a week. And every week that we met, we would cover one chapter in the big book. It did not matter if I was going to meet with him for an hour or 4 hours. We were going to cover a chapter in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 4 months, I started sponsoring people. And I've never looked back. Now, I work in this industry. I own a program. It is not my 12-step work. I sacrifice my personal time to work one-on-one and take guys through the big book. It's not the same. Yeah, I get a great amount of pleasure of watching guys go through my program and they get better. It doesn't hold a candle to what happens when I spend my personal time when there's nothing expected in return, and I get to witness the recreative power of God right before my eyes. That is as addictive as any crack rock that I ever hit. Watching someone else change is an experience you must not miss. I cannot emphasize that enough. If no one has told you that your permanent recovery is contingent on that, they have lied to you. They have lied to you. So, I start working the steps. I'm in a treatment center. And how does this happen? I'm in this treatment center. Treatment center comes to me and says, will you do a big book study for us? So I'm in the treatment center as a client doing a big book study for everyone and the staff. And then after I had 6 months, they offered me a job at the treatment center. So I began to work at that treatment center. And I got another job parking cars. I got back into grad school. I eventually graduated the program. I got my own apartment. I verified my employment, verified my admission into school. And I had some other things that I put in this file, and I had this ongoing court case. And my lawyer convinced me I was going to prison for 3 years. He's like, man, that's the worst. That's the best deal I'm going to be able to work out for you. And I would call my sponsor drowning in fear. I don't want to go to prison. And he says, Tarek, if you work these 12 steps, if you repair the damaged relationships that you've devastated, and you try to help others work the 12 steps, you're going to be okay with whatever happens. If you go back to living the way you were living, it's not going to end well for you. And I believed him, and I worked with that prayer on page 68. God, please remove my fear, direct my attention to what you would have me be. And I can't tell you how many times I said that prayer every day. And then 9 months to the day, on August 5th, 2008, my lawyer has filed a motion to suppress evidence because we believe they illegally searched and detained me. And he took this folder in to meet with the DA that had all this progress this young man was trying to make, and the DA dropped all the charges. I didn't have community service. I didn't get put on probation. Two Schedule 1 drug trafficking charges disappeared. I know what you're thinking to yourself. That is a miracle. And yes, it's a miracle. The word miracle means something you cannot explain has just transpired right before your eyes. And I made a commitment to my Creator standing in my kitchen that morning that I was going to do the work out of that big book from that moment until whenever God decides to take this spirit out of this body and move it somewhere else. No further authentication was necessary for me. I bought it, all of it. I drank the Kool-Aid. That's it. That's what my life is dedicated to, living the way of life described in that big book. And since then, my life has been an upward trajectory with a lot of dips and valleys. But as the weekend unfolds, I'm going to share some of my valleys and dips with you, because that's more important than sharing the exciting, cool stuff. I think they're both important. But for you guys to realize that, you know, I went through a period of time where I lost my daughter, I lost my wife, I lost my house, I lost my father to cancer. There was a 2-3 week period where I was homeless, in recovery, bouncing around on couches, and sleeping in like a friend's extra bedroom because I had no place to call home. And this happens while I'm in recovery, and I moved through it with somewhat ease and comfort. I was safe and protected. It was very exhausting. Going through a separation with my wife and sitting at my dad's deathbed, watching him transition into whatever is next and doing it clean and sober is quite miraculous. What's even more miraculous is actually crushing up all the Valium and the Oxycontin and the morphine and mixing it with the Dilaudid and sticking it in my dad. Called a position of neutrality. It was invisible to me. Hell, the nurse turns to me and she's like, man, you do that better than most of my nurses. I said, I know. And so all of these are miracles to me. And because the struggle for me is sacred, man. We live in this society, man. Everybody wants to eat organic food. Everybody wants to go to yoga. Everybody wants to do this. Everybody wants to do that. Why? Why do we all want to do that? Because we want to avoid the struggle at all costs. I get it's a good lifestyle, but truly, what's the intent underneath all of that? Not to struggle. And the struggle is sacred, because as I struggle, there is a layer after layer that's being shed. And I'm growing closer and closer to having this communion with what I call God. That's what happens in struggle. That's the stuff I like to share about in meetings. All the goofy stuff that I do, all the insane stuff that I do. Why? Because insanity and goofiness leads to the most sincere prayer life I've ever experienced. I go to God on my knees. I feel a sadness in my heart because I betray God with every breath. That's what these 12 steps have done for me. And that's why we're here this weekend, is to share our experience. But see, what Brandon and I do is we literally, if we think of God being a river, this weekend what Brandon and I keep doing, we're going to run to the river and bring you back handfuls of water. But what we're really telling you guys is to go to the river. Go to the river. You got anything else before we take a break? Let's take a 15-minute break, guys. Thanks for listening. Thank you.